From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with writer Gore Vidal, one of our country's most prolific and controversial literary figures. He's written several plays and more than 22 novels about politics, history, and sex. We also get a glimpse inside the quirky mind of comedian Jonathan Winters. Winters has made a career of creating and portraying a collection of oddball characters. We'll meet Jonathan Winters and a few of his inventions. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews four new reissues of pianist Arthur Schnabel performing the music of Mozart. And Jan Harald Brundtvand is back with another urban legend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Gore Vidal describes himself as obsessed with his country. His grandfather was a senator. His father served in FDR's cabinet. And Gore Vidal even ran for public office twice, but he lost. Vidal's obsession with his country has been expressed mostly through his writing. He's currently completing a series of historical novels, which includes the books Burr, Lincoln, 1876, Empire, and Washington, D.C. When it comes to current political affairs, Vidal expresses his barbed criticisms in essays. His 1982 collection of essays, The Second American Revolution, won a National Book Critics Circle Award for criticism. His new book, At Home, reflects on such political figures as Richard Nixon, Oliver North, and the Reagans, and on literary figures such as Tennessee Williams and Henry James. Vidal is also the author of the controversial satiric novel Myra Breckinridge, one of the first popular books to feature a transsexual as its main character. Gore Vidal says he consciously avoids writing about himself, a practice he finds narcissistic. But the opening essay starts on a personal note, and I asked him to read a brief excerpt.
Like so many blind people, my grandfather was a passionate sightseer, not to mention a compulsive guide. One of my first memories is driving with him to a slum in southeast Washington, D.C. All this, he said, pointing at the dilapidated red brick buildings, was once our land. Since I saw only shabby buildings and could not imagine the land beneath, I was not impressed.
What kind of response do you think your grandfather expected you to have when he said all of this was once our land?
Well, my grandfather was completely blind at the age of 10, so he had no memories of what that land, what had happened to it in the half century that intervened between his 10th year and when he was showing around his 10-year-old grandson. So I think he thought I'd be looking at beautiful farmland that had once been a part of Maryland that had then been torn away by General George Washington in 1800 to make the District of Columbia. He thought I would look upon our past. All I saw was a slum. There were two branches of the Gore family. One went west, which meant Mississippi, and the other stayed and did not sell out to General Washington, and that branch of the family became very rich. My branch became very poor.
I wonder if it gave you a sense of a proprietary sense about America to have a grandfather point to all this land and say, this was once ours.
Well, we've been around sort of like George Bush trying, after all the Ellis Island stuff of Dukakis, you could see poor George Bush trying to do Ellis Rock for everybody. You remember when he said, my family, you know, we came over on the Bloomingdale or something, and he was reading a joke, and we were waving Mayflower bags, and everybody's shaking their head, no, it's the other way around. Well, the families like the Gores, my mother's family, came over in the 1680s, 1690s, and we were among the original settlers, and we were a political family from then to the present day, including the dread young Albert Gore, who's a as he got more and more political, his cousinage to me got more and more distant. But it's a network of family, mostly in the South, mostly centered around nowadays Virginia, Mississippi, and Tennessee.
Now, although you've run for office twice, you were defeated both times, but you've spent a lot more time writing about politics and history than actually being in the political arena.
Than actually making it, is what you were tactfully trying to say. I was writing about it, that's quite true, but I've always been political, and the two races that I did in my lifetime were more to see what was going on. You can't really understand politics unless you've been a politician.
Uh-huh.
And I have been one, and in a sense I am always one, since I spend most of my time brooding about the Republic and American affairs. And then I set out to do the history of the United States as seen from the point of view of one rather complicated family. And I have now done 5 of those volumes, from Burr to Lincoln to Washington, D.C. And I do the 6th right now as we speak. I'm working on it. Then I do a summing up, and in 7 volumes I will have told the story of our 2 centuries as a country. So, yes, proprietary is the word you use, and proprietary is the word I would use. I regard this republic as a family affair.
You once said that you weren't from the writer's class, and I wasn't really sure whether you meant that ironically or seriously. But I was wondering if fellow writers like Norman Mailer made you feel very patrician.
Oh, Norman never makes me feel patrician. We're ancient colleagues. We're the last of the Second World War writers, really, to still be working and surviving and getting along. No, when I said that, what I meant was that when you come from a family that has been political, and I was brought up by my grandfather in the Senate, my father was in Roosevelt's cabinet, this is not the class that produces writers or reflective people. And of my kind of family, it produces George Bushes, you know, for good or for ill. That is what the old WASP establishment comes up with. I have some Italian blood, so I'm about 3/4 WASP. I think that's really the difference. Most writers are middle class and are the children of doctors or lawyers. And like Ernest Hemingway say, they were Middle Westerners, sort of out of it from the professional classes who had plenty of money to send them to Harvard or wherever. And I came out of Capitol Hill. Well, that's just not an ordinary background for a writer of the ordinary American sort. The British, you know, are absolutely hung up on class. And whenever they start to really... Class for the English is like sex for Americans. They start to shake all over. The subject comes up, begin to salivate. And I was on the BBC once, and this lady was interviewing me, and she said, "And now, Mr. Vidal, what class do you think you belong to in America?" And I could see no matter what answer I made, it was going to be wrong. So I gave her a cold stare on the camera, and I said, "I come from the highest class of all. I am a third-generation celebrity. I have been on the cover of Time magazine. My father was on the cover of Time, and my grandfather was on the cover of Time."
Well, that's great. I really do believe there is a celebrity class in the United States. But
you bet there is. I'm in Hollywood right now, surrounded by nothing but the sons and grandsons of movie stars.
But it's interesting you should bring that up, because in many ways you were the first generation of writer celebrities who were made famous in part through television. And I think that you and Norman Mailer, Truman Capote, both of whom you've had celebrated battles with, are also in that generation of writer celebrities who were helped so much by appearances on television.
Well, it certainly was true in my case. I was extremely unpopular with the establishment of the United States, particularly the New York Times was always an enemy, and Time magazine off and on an enemy, because I said things and took positions that other people didn't do. So if you are at the mercy of what they call print interviews and the mercy of people who write about you, they can always tell lies. And you have no way of redress until suddenly... My first book was 1946, and television didn't really start going till early 50s. Suddenly there was television, and they had to fill up all that time, and writers talked rather better than movie stars. So suddenly writers were often asked to be guests. And I seized this new medium in order to break through what the print had done to me. You see, if you're a critic of the rulers of the United States, you're either demonized or you're trivialized by the press, and they do a very good job of making you into a non-person or a ridiculous person. I could then go on television, and one appearance would absolutely reverse what people have been reading about me.
So you were really very conscious and very savvy in how you used TV.
Oh, yes, indeed, I was. Capote and Mailer never really mastered it. Capote just went on and gossiped about rich ladies. And Norman was just far too tense for television. Television is a cool medium, and Norman always came on too hot, and so it was not a natural medium for him. I was very much at home with it.
My guest is Gore Vidal, who, by the way, has a new collection of essays called At Home. You know, you were talking about some of the negative responses you got from critics early on. In 1948, you wrote a novel called The City and the Pillar, and that was about a gay man. Now, back in the late 1940s, I think it was very brave for somebody to write a novel in which there was a leading gay character.
Well, actually, quote, gay, unquote, the point to the story, which caused all the fuss, was that he wasn't. He was a perfectly normal young man who had an affair with another normal young man, and one went off to get married and conduct an absolutely admired heterosexual life, and the other one didn't. But what I was saying, that early on, before the word gay had really been invented, was there's no such thing. Only a country basically as mindless about these matters, based upon our peasant superstitions, religious superstitions, would they make categories. Everybody's everything. And I was talking about the normality. This is a book called The City and the Pillar, which opened a floodgate. The normality of this sort of relationship, you could not say that. The New York Times refused to advertise the book. The leading reviewer said he would never read, much less review, a book of mine again. I took a lot of flack. The book was a big bestseller and was followed about 3 months later by Dr. Kinsey's report on the human male. And Dr. Kinsey said, well, 37% of American males have dealt in this infernal and abominable act at least once. We were still able to win the Second World War, the last war we ever won.
Was the response to that book part of the reason why you started writing for television in Hollywood?
Oh, yeah. It meant that I was blacked out, and my next 5 books were not reviewed in the New York Times daily, nor in Time magazine, nor in Newsweek. That's what I call a blackout.
Mm-hmm.
So to survive, I turned to television. They didn't care about television. They barely reviewed it. And made my way there, and then I went to the movies and to the stage with Visit to a Small Planet and The Best Man. So by the time I went back to the novel, I could not be blacked out. But I still could be demonized, and I could still be trivialized.
When you went to Hollywood, I think this was in the early 1950s, and you wrote at MGM, you once described yourself as an alien integer from the world of quality writers. And I was wondering if the studio treated you with superstition because you were a novelist.
Oh, no. I mean, there was one point. They had something called the writer's table in the commissary where you'd go in to have lunch, and I remember sitting there one day. There was Aldous Huxley, there was Christopher Isherwood, there was John O'Hara, and me, and Dorothy Parker. Well, that's pretty good for one lunch. They had an awful lot of alien integers
right, hanging
around. Curiously enough, we weren't as good at writing movies as the hacks, but they didn't find that out till too late.
One of the things you're credited for during your stay in Hollywood is having written in the gay subtext in the movie Ben-Hur. And this was like the motivation for rivalry between the Charlton Heston and Stephen Boyd characters. And the code was, the Hays Code was still in effect at that time. I was wondering about how much you could imply in that homosexual subtext without the Hays Code coming in and taking
it out.
Well,
it wasn't that it was so much a homosexual. Again, I don't approve of these categories. I said that to justify the fact that the two guys meet, they haven't seen each other since they were kids. One is Roman and the other is a Jewish liberationist in Palestine, and the Roman wants to make a deal with his old Jewish friend. The Jewish friend rejects him. I said, to do this on political grounds is not enough to sustain a 2.5-3-hour movie. There's not enough emotion under it. Just a political argument is not enough for such hatred, I said to Willie Wyler, the director. I said, I will write it that they once, as kids, had an affair. We don't go into any details, and who knows what an affair is. They might never have touched each other. But I'm going to write that in, and the Roman wants to resume the old relationship, and the Jewish liberationist Ben-Hur doesn't want to. I said, without ever mentioning what this is about, if that's written in there in the undertext of what they're saying, it'll give the scene a lot of power. Weiler said, well, anything's better than what we've got. We had the world's worst script that we'd inherited. And he said, you tell Stephen Boyd, I won't. Don't say a word to Heston or he'll fall apart. So Heston did the whole thing. Heston has 8 profiles, and he showed all 8 of his profiles, and Stephen Boyd is looking at him like a hungry man waiting for dinner, and it's a wonderful scene. And the audience doesn't quite know what it is, but they know something very electrical is happening between these two people. And that is what gave the energy that drove the film, kept you going to the chariot race.
Now, the Hays Code people didn't notice this?
Oh, of course not. I mean, that was one of the great fun we had with the code, was getting things by that they never suspected what you were doing. They were too busy having, 1 foot on the floor when the married couple were in bed to show that, little knowing that you could have 1 foot on the floor and heaven knows what could be going on.
Well, I want to talk with you about some of your historical novels, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is outspoken social critic and author Gore Vidal. His new collection of essays is titled At Home, and it includes personal reflections on the role of writing in his life and essays on figures such as Oliver North, Oscar Wilde, and Richard Nixon. He's joining us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. We'll be back in a few seconds. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Gore Vidal is my guest. His new collection of essays is called At Home. We were talking earlier at the beginning of our conversation about how so many people in your family had been involved with politics and how you go back generations in America. Is that why you've been writing about history in your novels for so many years?
No, I think I got interested in history because of my interest in politics. And the more you get interested in politics, the more you're curious about how we have certain attitudes. Then you start to look back and say, well, where did they come from? And then I was brought up in a family that was very much aware of its own past. So the sense of the United States as being it's only 200 years old, and I've lived through nearly one-third of the history of the country. My grandfather, Senator Gore, was born in 1870, so between the two of us, we encompass more than half the life of the Republic. So when I start to write about it, I'm really writing about my own family. And then I move in on various figures. As I did, say, in Lincoln, I focused on him. In Burr, I was on Burr and Jefferson and Hamilton and George Washington. These do not seem very remote to me, these people. They seem quite close. Mm-hmm. And there's still stories in the family about my great-great-great-great-grandfather in the Revolution. And I have an ancestor that I never took any credit for until I came to write Empire, which deals 1898 to 1907. And my great-grandmother was Catherine McKinley, who was the first cousin of the president. I never claimed this because I thought he was one of the more boring presidents. Now that I realize that he gave us our empire, got us the Philippine Islands and the Marquesas in due course, I now proudly boast that I am President McKinley's great-great-nephew or something.
You've written about conflicts between the public self and the private self. You've said everyone has a public and a private self, and that with you, your private self is devoted to literature and your public self wants to prevent the end of the world, and your public self is willing, therefore, to sacrifice art and private pleasure to be of use. Are you still undergoing that conflict in yourself?
Well, I think everybody does. That those things which one most likes to do, let us say, just taking a drive along the Pacific Palisades, well, if you start to think about the consequences of that drive and all the carbon monoxide you're making and the ozone and so on, you realize that you're a destructive part of a destructive chain that is destroying the environment. I mean, if you stop to think, fortunately most people don't, but if you stop to think, you can get very distressed by just your own habits, what they do that is deleterious to all of us. What to do? Well, that's called politics, or that's what politics ought to be until the invention of the TV commercial on television.
But I figure your private self is probably pretty happy that your public self didn't win when you ran for office in elections, because it would have really forced your more literary self to be submerged for a while. Probably
well,
wouldn't have been time for that.
I was willing to give up. In 1982, I would have given 6 years of my life to go to the Senate and ask questions. I would have thought that was an honorable thing to do and would have been useful then. It's now far too late for me or anybody else to contribute much of anything to what is now an ongoing mess. We are approaching a major economic crisis, a depression. I think what's probably been done to the environment all around the world is irreversible. But I don't, you know, one must not be too negative, or because there may be some bright kid listening who will suddenly answer all our problems.
Is it acceptable in your family, in your family of politicians, to be this negative about the state of politics? And I should mention here, you were born at West Point. You were born at a military academy.
In the cadet hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Delivered by the officer of the day. Well, negative or not, it is not usual for any public figure of any kind in the United States, political or otherwise, to tell the truth. Everybody's hustling and everybody has a scam. And the first law of the jungle out there, whether you're running for president or flogging a book or something, is I won't give away your scam, you don't give away my scam. Then along comes somebody like me who is devoted to telling the truth as to the extent I understand what is true. I can be mistaken, of course. And a figure like myself is very difficult for American culture to deal with.
You know, it's funny, though, that you think of yourself as being so demonized. You've had so many bestsellers. You've been on TV so much in the United States. It hardly seems that you've really been kept out of the dialogue of American culture.
Oh, yes, pretty much. The public and I get along very well. The press and I have our ups and downs. But, for instance, there was a study of the American novel since the Second World War. I think something like 500 people were discussed. My name was never mentioned. Now, that's Prince Hamlet without the prince, since I have been central to the novel for the last 50 years. That means the universities cannot cope with me. They have to now. They're beginning to write biographies of me and so on. But I'm a non-person on a campus because I am distressing to the people who give them their money. Now, that's one example right there. And since the universities have now taken over literature pretty much, and they even make it on campus, Professor X writes a novel which Professor Y will teach. And the poor kids who have to read this stuff either don't take English courses anymore or they become, in due course, Professor Z and Professor A, and they continue this priestly tradition.
I was wondering what your reaction was to the beginning of the gay liberation movement. And I ask this because I think it changed the rules of the game for public figures who were either gay or bisexual or who wrote about characters who had homosexual or bisexual experiences.
Well, as I said earlier, yes, I'm for any minority that is getting it from the majority. So obviously I'm in favor of protecting the rights of everybody, gay, black, women, what have you, American Indians. I'm all for that. But I deny that there's such a thing as a gay person. I deny there's such a thing as a heterosexual person.
What?
What's a heterosexual sensibility? What on earth do...
Well, before we get into sensibility, I mean, why deny that some people prefer to have intimate relations with someone of the same sex, and others prefer to have intimate relations with someone of the opposite sex? I mean,
well, everybody.
What do you find offensive about that kind of categorizing?
Because it's like saying, well, I like potatoes very much, and I can't stand turnips, but I'll eat a turnip every now and then. This is all a matter of personal taste. These are not categories. The word heterosexual is an adjective. The word homosexual is an adjective. They describe an activity. Of course there's a homosexual activity. Of course there's a heterosexual activity. But there's no homosexual person. There's no heterosexual person. Everybody is everything. What they may do may be one or the other or this or that. It's like saying, oh, I want you to meet Mildred. This is potato-eating Mildred. Oh, my God, I'm sorry, but I Don't want to be at the same table with a potato eater. Sorry, Mildred, but some other time. Now, that's only a country that is based upon an extremely primitive religion, which is Christianity. I am a devoted enemy of monotheism in all of its forms, could have come up with the categorizing of people as one thing or the other. There is the good straight team and there is the bad queer team. Only a bunch of lunatics would have come up with this. Western Europe looks upon us. They are richer than we are, more populous than we are. And except for the Brits, who are kind of out of their skulls, collectively speaking, not individually, in Europe, these distinctions are not only not known, but we're thought to be mad. Latins just roar with laughter. In the town of Ravello, where I have a house, from the Supreme Court, said that an act of sodomy, as they describe it, could not be committed between a man and his wife. The entire square burst into laughter. And I was actually stopped all day long by Italians, these villagers, saying, what kind of country is this? And I said, well, it's a very primitive country, the United States, and it's full of superstitions which come out of a very fundamental religious bias, which is primitive Christianity. And since they have enough votes to terrify the more sophisticated people who run the country, these are some of the bones that they get thrown, like prayer in the schools and abortion and all subjects which have nothing to do with the federal government, but they see to it that it does. No, no, we're kind of a joke.
Well, let me ask you this. In your novel Myron, which was a follow-up to Myra Breckinridge, Myra Breckinridge was about a transsexual, and Myron was about her male alter ego. In that novel, you used the names of Supreme Court justices as substitutes for words describing genitals and sexual acts. What kind of response did you get from the justices?
The justices maintained a lofty silence, but the Solicitor General of the United States was asked by David Susskind to go on television with me and discuss other matters, but that would come up. And the Solicitor General of the United States said, I do not think it'd be seemly for the Solicitor General to go on with Gore Vidal and have a fit. And the Solicitor General was one Mr. Bork, whose name I certainly should have added to those abominable acts that I use the names of justices to describe.
No, I should say here that you used their names as an act of protest against censorship?
Against censorship. They had come up with a terrible decision, and I was rewarding them. In my latest version of Myron, I removed the names of the justices and went back to good old Anglo-Saxon words.
Did you have to figure out which words you meant in the first place?
Well, look at the justice and the epithet
right, okay.
Rises to one's pen.
Okay. We only have a few seconds remaining, so let me ask you if you think that presidential politics is declining.
I think that what is wrong is systemic. I am for calling another constitutional convention. The system does not work. I would like another constitution, a different system, and I would like us to try political parties, something we have never had, as the Republican Party is exactly the same as the Democratic Party, and they're paid for by the same people, so we have no choice.
Okay. Thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Gore Vidal, and his new book of essays, At Home, is published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Neil Jordan. His cinematic style of writing led him to a career in film. He co-wrote and directed Mona Lisa, Company of Wolves, and Danny Boy. His new film, High Spirits, is his first big-budget Hollywood project. It stars Daryl Hannah and Steve Guttenberg. I hope you can join us.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There's no telling just who comedian Jonathan Winters will be next. Maybe it's an elderly, lecherous woman, or maybe a shoot-first, think-later Marine. Since the early days of television, Winters' improvisations have delighted audiences. Coming up, we meet a few characters from Jonathan Winters' cast of thousands. It's been more than 40 years since pianist Arthur Schnabel recorded Mozart's piano concertos, sonatas, and rondos. But classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says those performances remain the greatest interpretations of these works. Lloyd reviews the new reissue of these vintage recordings. And urban legend expert Jan Harald Brunvand tells the tale of the rabbit that came back from the grave. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. Nationalism in the Soviet Republic of Estonia is intensifying. Today, the Estonian legislature overwhelmingly opposed Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev's blueprint for redesigning the national government. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
The Estonians say Gorbachev's plan would give the national government broad authority to dictate social and economic policy. The Estonians have been arguing for just the opposite, more local control. After condemning Gorbachev's proposals, the legislature voted overwhelmingly to give Estonia veto power over Moscow's policies. The Kremlin offered no immediate reaction to the defiant vote. Gorbachev's political proposals are scheduled for adoption by the national legislature on November 29th. It's not clear whether the rebellion in Estonia will gain enough support by then to stop the reforms. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Sudanese rebels and political leaders met today to finish drafting a ceasefire agreement to end a 5-year-old civil war in southern Sudan. The conference in Addis Ababa was attended by leaders of the rebel Sudan People's Liberation Front and the Democratic Unionist Party. The agreement was at first scheduled to be signed Monday, but has twice been postponed without explanation. Vice President Bush sought to quell speculation about his choices for top administration posts today, that amidst reports that he has asked New Hampshire Governor John Sununu to be his chief of staff. NPR's Jim Angle has more.
The vice president denied today reports he has made his choice for the critical position of White House chief of staff. He talked with reporters just before a meeting with Soviet dissident Andrei Sakharov.
I'll make a deal with all of you guys. You will be amongst the first to know when I have an announcement to make on that position or any other.
Is it still open, or have you decided?
No final decisions taken.
Stay tuned, he told reporters. Sununu has been repeatedly mentioned as a possibility for White House chief of staff. That speculation was fueled when the New Hampshire governor flew to Florida to talk with Bush during his post-election vacation. Though staff members say Bush is keeping his own counsel, one aide said, "I don't think Sununu flew to Florida to share a crab claw with the vice president." Meanwhile, transition directors Craig Fuller and Robert Teeter are meeting daily with Bush to go over prospective nominees for the remaining cabinet posts. And they will meet tomorrow to look at the short list for 2 or 3 of those positions. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
A report in the New York Times today says government officials want to limit the rights of the elderly and disabled in seeking welfare, Medicare, and Social Security benefits. The report says a proposal would make it more difficult for people to appeal decisions that deny them government benefits. Meanwhile, former President Gerald Ford said today that he approves caps on Social Security payouts, government pensions, and military spending. Ford was giving advice to President-elect George Bush while speaking to a group of executives in San Francisco. The State Department denied as baloney today a report from Beirut that an American-Iranian deal was in the works for the release of U.S. hostages in Lebanon. The Reuters news agency, citing a Muslim security source, said Iranian and U.S. representatives were holding talks involving the possible release of the American hostages, the reopening of the U.S. embassy in Tehran, and the release of Iranian assets being held in the U.S. Two Americans jailed for allegedly taking part in a plot to overthrow Liberian President Samuel Doe have been released. The men, former U.S. Army Sergeant James Henry Bush from Baltimore and William Elmer Curtis of Jersey City, say they plan to return to the U.S. tomorrow. They've been jailed in Liberia for 4 months. Doe ordered the charges against the two men dropped after they wrote a letter of apology. On Wall Street, stocks tumbled to their lowest level in more than 2 months today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slid more than 38 points to close at 2038.58 on a volume of 161.7 million shares. Average price of a share, 49 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Olaf pianist Artur Schnabel's Mozart recordings have just been reissued on four compact discs on the Arabesque label. The performances were originally recorded between 1934 and 1948. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz is a big Schnabel fan, and he has a personal story to share about how much these recordings have meant to him.
Artur Schnabel isn't as well known for his Mozart or Bach as for his Beethoven and Schubert, but this has nothing to do with his artistry. He's the greatest Mozart pianist I've ever heard. His touch, his phrasing, his insights are as searching as they are in Beethoven and Schubert. But for as long as I can remember, his Mozart recordings have been harder to find, much harder. I remember one Schnabel recording I found years ago. I was spending a summer in Santa Fe, trying to preserve a relationship that was going sour. I had lost my teaching job, and at summer's end I would have to return to Boston, probably alone and unemployed. One of the uncomplicated pleasures of Santa Fe was a small record shop run by a former classical music disc jockey from Chicago, who was forced to retire because of his heart condition. He had wonderful out-of-print records and great stories. I was broke. I barely had my fare home, which in a way made visiting a record store a very liberating experience. But a few days before I left, a record turned up that I'd been wanting for years, a long out-of-print LP of Artur Schnabel playing two of Mozart's very greatest piano concertos, the powerful D minor and the heartbreaking, heartbroken C minor. They were Schnabel's last Mozart recordings and issued posthumously. I still remember the price, $12.50. A steal, really, but how could I afford it? The owner was willing to keep it for me, but I couldn't wait. I had to have it. And with practically my last cent, I bought it. I played it as soon as I got back to Boston, and it was everything I imagined. These were among the most profound, moving performances of Mozart, of anything I'd ever heard. They actually helped me see my life from a new and longer perspective. Later, my mother called to tell me that someone from a school I'd applied to in the spring had been trying urgently to track me down. A job had opened up. I wasn't going to be destitute. And I had my Schnabel. Now no one has to suffer to find Schnabel's marvelous Mozart records. They're all here. The sublime two-piano concerto that he plays with his son Carl Ulrich. It's regarded as a lightweight piece, but as played by the Schnabels, it's not so much lightweight as weightless. There's the D minor, with its dark rumblings of Don Giovanni, and the aching C minor, with its notoriously modern cadenzas composed by Schnabel himself. There's the tenderly playful number 19, and the sensual number 21, and number 27, Mozart's last piano concerto, in which he discovered a radical and mysterious new simplicity. Schnabel recorded only three Mozart sonatas, the last one, the tragic A minor, and the ravishingly ambiguous F major, now officially released in America for the first time. There's the great G minor piano quartet with members of the warmly remembered Pro Arte string quartet, and finally, the A minor rondo, one of Mozart's most exquisite yet monumental miniatures, like Blake's World in a Grain of Sand. Music doesn't get much better than this.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new series of compact discs featuring Arthur Schnabel playing Mozart on the Arabesque label. This is Fresh Air. When Jonathan Winters came onto the comedy scene in the mid-1950s, there was no one else like him. He did free-associating improvisations in which he'd slip into different characters. The characters were all creations of his imagination, and he gave each one a different voice and set of facial expressions. Robin Williams has credited Winters with inspiring his own brand of manic improvisation. Winters was a popular guest on all the TV talk shows in the 50s and 60s and starred in several movies, but for many years he's kept out of the public eye with the exception of trash bag commercials, occasional TV appearances, and guest shots with Robin Williams on his TV show Mork and Mindy. But last year, Winters' collection of short stories became a surprise bestseller, and he's just followed that up with a new book of paintings. In the introduction to this new book, Winters says that painting has always been a great place for him to hide. Winter says that his childhood was lonely and unhappy, and he used his art, like he would later use his comedy, as a way to freely express himself.
Every once in a while, you find a man or a woman that had not only a strange childhood, but maybe they weren't allowed to be children. I thought for a long time, I still do, that I was a grown-up. Not that I was grown-up intellectually, it took me quite a while to mature, and I still am in that respect. But as far as being an adult, I felt that I was an adult when I was about seven. I thought, boy, I was more. I was an elderly man. I was a little old child in many ways. And it wasn't until a number of years later, well into my 40s, that I decided, boy, now's the time to be a kid again, to wear these funny costumes. I remember my father was always saying, you're not going outside dressed like that, are you? And I didn't think it was that different. I had on sort of a rubber claw that was on my hand, and I had a bandana around my head so that it made me some kind of a militant. Before militants were really militants and fashionable or terrorists, I had on heavy shades and maybe a white stick and a dead monkey on my shoulder. And he said, why do you dress like this? Why? You merely draw attention to yourself. And I said, well, that's what I'm looking for. I'm obviously not getting it from you, so I'll have to try to get it in front of the post office.
Were any of the characters that you created characters who you saw yourself as, characters that really came out of your own personal life?
Well, I think probably out of my own personal life, Chester Honeyhugger is the character that's basically me, that was in all through school sort of struggling and failing and passing now and then and looking out the window and looking at girls and the teacher saying, Chester, are you paying attention? You're not, are you? You wonder why you fail. Why do you constantly look out the window? It's snowing. Isn't it, class? Everybody, it's snowing. Yeah, it is snowing. And I'd rather be out there on a flexible flyer. I'd rather be in the snow. I'd have a lot more fun. And I was noticing the woodpecker put his beak in the tree. He probably gets more maple sugar than any other bird.
Why do you say that? Why do you say that?
I guess because I want to be an ornithologist.
Where did you learn that word?
I don't know, but I know it's right. But he was always a kid that wasn't a wise guy, but he picked out these wonderful words, and he just happened to get lucky every once in a while. Basically a failure, but on certain words he'd be right. And that's why I used Chester that way. It was a great, and still is, part of me. I mean, there's a great sadness, but fun in Chester. He's, well, it's like, you know, God is in my mind, the devil's in my pants. he was always, you know, hi, Sally. Hey, listen, I'll stop it, Chester. Stop pulling my hair. You have beautiful hair. And you know, you're a natural Scandinavian blonde. My mother has brownie mouse hair. She pays over $56. That's just in a tip to have it made blonde. You're a lovely person. I wish I had money to marry you. But I don't have a job Saturday. I got fired from Weber's grocery store. Otherwise, I could buy you that orphan any ring. You have too many boyfriends. Your mind is going to be crowded. And so that's pretty much Chester.
Are these characters still close to you? Do you still carry them around in your mind?
Oh, yes. I was an only child, and I didn't have any brothers or sisters. As I look back over my shoulder, I think, oh, God, maybe it was a blessing I didn't have a sister. I'm sure I would have been in there asking, you know, to see her robe, or could I try her shoes on? If I had a brother, he would have been beating me up and probably locking me in the furnace until spring.
Why would you have wanted to try your sister's clothes on?
Why? Oh, I think, well, to my knowledge, a lot of guys with sisters have wanted to do that, and vice versa. My mother used to put clothes on me, her clothes, and I almost went back to live with my father. They were divorced when I was 7. And then, strangely enough, he wanted to put my grandmother's dress on me. So it was a wild kind of thing. I just wanted to end up in a civilian conservation corps. I wanted to pick up, you know, pine cones and just live with bears.
I hope you don't mind my asking this. I know in 1959 you spent around 8 months in a sanitarium.
Mm.
And I was wondering if when you were there you were worried that the doctors would try to cure you of comedy and to cure you of all the characters in your head.
Well, I think lawyers cure you of comedy. doctors stare at you. They really don't know. They just, in fairness to doctors, they go, how are we feeling? I had a couple of weeks, and that was in 59. And then I realized I had to get some money. I owed some money to some people, and not relatives. They never had it. And certainly I never asked my mother and dad. These are car dealers. And so I had to get well quickly. There was no sense of my sitting around here. But I think I would give this much advice, if I may. And it's only from an outpatient. My insanity, I've been called crazy. And a woman the other day pointed me a very strong lady in army clothes. She'd come out of a 5 and 10, and she was in a camouflaged outfit. I think she was on her way to purchase a handgun, and she was quite strong. She was a truck driver, but she's a very, very strong woman. Probably lived in Russia, you know, in the north. But she said, "You know, you're crazy." And I said, "Yes, I think I'm aware of that. It's always overly sensitive people like yourself that spot us." Went right past her. I don't know. I've always enjoyed my craziness. I made it go to work for me. I just didn't sit down beside chicken wire or iron. I decided that this was my role, and I got to do something about it. And I think the thing is to just do the best you can and bring a little laughter. If you don't, you know, a guy out in California the other day, a UCLA graduate, said to me, doing a paper, "What are you afraid of the most?" Which is a very, very heavy question. There are so many things. I'm almost now completely paranoid. I'm afraid of everything. And if I see a shadow, I think it's time to go. If I see a bird, I know it's going to attack me. If it's a beggar, I'm sure that if I put something in the cup, it'll blow up. Both of us will have to go. He's probably a Buddhist. But at any rate, I said, "I'm scared to death of a man or a woman without a sense of humor." Because to me, if you don't have that, then I'm really frightened. And there are a surprising amount of people out there that don't have a sense of humor.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life. Thank you very
much. Well, thank you, and I hope to see you. You're in Washington now?
Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Well, I'll come by at an odd hour, my dear.
Right.
Probably crawl up the... Are you in a house or in an apartment?
The radio station.
I'll find you.
Okay.
If you see little funny suction cups and a man smiling at the damnedest hour, it's me.
I'll be looking.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye, and thank you.
Thank you.
Jonathan Winter's new book of paintings, titled Hang-Ups, is published by Random House. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel with a look ahead at today's All Things Considered. We'll have reports on what passes for transition fever in Washington, D.C. this week. It's a very unfeverish handoff from the Reagan administration to the Bush administration. Now that the president-elect has named his Secretary of State and his Secretary of Treasury, the word is, it's not confirmed, but everybody seems to think that former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu will be the next White House Chief of Staff. Also, we'll have reports on the Pakistani elections and news about crime. A crime wave in France has provoked talk of restoring the guillotine as the means of execution there, and also sociologist Jack Katz, who writes about the moral and sensual attractions of doing evil. Those stories coming up later on NPR's All Things Considered.
Most of us think of rabbits as furry, cute, and warm, but urban legends expert Jan Harald Brunvand has a tale in which the rabbit is less appealing, it's dead.
As far as urban legends go, this is the year of the rabbit. The hottest story going around has been one about a dead rabbit that gets blow-dried. I call it the hair dryer. The story goes like this. One day a woman is horrified when she sees her dog holding a dead rabbit in its mouth. Her neighbors have always kept a pet rabbit in a cage behind the house, and she recognizes the dead animal as the neighbor's pet. The woman cleans the rabbit, blow-dries its fur, and replaces it in its cage in a lifelike posture. The next day she sees a police car parked in front of her neighbor's house. Curious, she goes outside and asks what's going on. A nuisance call, the officer says. Their pet rabbit died yesterday, and some weirdo dug it up and put it back in its cage. I don't know exactly how the hairdryer got started, but I recognize the legend as one in a long line of other stories about a dead animal either being posed by someone as if it were still alive or else switched with a live animal. These earlier stories are often told about either farmers or airline baggage handlers. In the dozens of versions of the hairdryer that I've collected, details vary, the kind of dog or the state of relations between the neighbors, but all versions agree that the dead bunny was blow-dried and returned to its hutch. The earliest printed version I've come across was in the Charleston, West Virginia Gazette. I've also found the story in other newspapers, and I've heard it from people in Illinois, California, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Texas, and Utah. I got two letters from England about this legend. One version featured a dead cat instead of a dead rabbit. In June, I got a telephone call from a man named Bruce in Philadelphia. He apologized for the intrusion, but said he was dying to know whether a story he had heard in a bagel shop that morning was an urban legend. So I told him to start telling it, and I would stop him when I recognized the story. He started out this way. Well, in a suburb here called Chestnut Hill, there's supposed to be this woman who had a large German shepherd as a pet. Stop, I said. Her neighbor kept a rabbit in her backyard, right? Bruce had, of course, heard the hairdryer legend. A couple of days later at dinner time, a radio talk show host in Los Angeles who consults me occasionally about urban legends called to ask if I would take a question on the air about a story that was going around. In the host version, a babysitter's dog drags in the dead rabbit. The babysitter washes the rabbit in woolite and hangs it by its ears in the shower to dry. The next afternoon, I came into the English department at the University of Utah where I teach. Our department assistant started to tell me about a hilarious dog and rabbit story she had heard on a local talk show the night before. So I played a little game with her. I said, here are five unopened letters you just gave me. I predict that at least one of them contains the same story that you heard on the radio. The first four letters lacked the rabbit tail, and I began to fear that my gambit would fail. Then I opened letter number five. Presto. It contained a clipping from the Salem, Oregon Statesman Journal in which the writer repeated a story he had heard about a man whose German short-haired hunting dog had dragged home the corpse of the neighbor's cat, and so on. I handed her the clipping, very pleased with myself. She protested, though, that this was a cat story, not a rabbit story. So I pointed to the conclusion of the Oregon newspaper column. It went like this. At about the same time I was being told about the kitty cat and the hunting dog, the same story was being told to a colleague, only there was a difference. The victim was a neighbor's pet bunny rabbit. Some days I maintain my reputation just by opening my mail.
Jan Harald Brunvand is professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Talk show host Joe Franklin has two entries in the Guinness Book of World Records, one for the longest-running talk show, 36 years, and the other for the most guests interviewed, 180,000. Next time we meet Franklin and learn the secret of his longevity. Rock Critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from two British groups, the Pet Shop Boys and Eighth Wonder. Ken says their sound is disco and deadpan, but still amusing. And film critic Stephen Schiff ventures into more overblown rock and roll. He'll review Rattle and Hum, U2's new concert film. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Vobleidis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.